provided jaw-dropping access to foreign intelligence, to technology platforms that would generate foreign intelligence, and to foreign nationals with access to secrets. Some private sector partners, in fact, were recruiting foreign nationals for us. They were that good. This was especially true in obscure areas of collection. One U.S. businessman, originally from Afghanistan, traveled back home to recruit and run a tight network of his clansmen against the Taliban. They were instrumental in our covert action efforts before and after 9/11. A U.S. scientist engaged with a foreign counterpart in an academic discussion and eventually, with the help of a case officer, recruited the source and obtained unique technical information about a foreign weapons program. Most case officers could never have recruited the Afghan clan or gained access to that foreign scientist. In scientific areas in particular, the private sector was essential. Very few operations officers knew anything about the flavors of quarks, nanostructure of self-assembly techniques, or closed-loop parallel chains in robot kinematics. Moreover, with the growing sophistication of foreign intelligence services, combined with advances in biometrics, it was more and more difficult for CIA officers to travel in different identities under commercial cover without being exposed. So I figured that U.S. private sector partners, traveling under their real names and working for their real companies, could serve as CIA reinforcements abroad. This was high risk, but so were the potential rewards. Third, many of the best and brightest foreign intelligence officers, diplomats, trade officials, scientists, and businessmen resided in the United States or visited often. They were potential spies for America. Every country in the world has some type of representation in the United States, as at the United Nations. Our home turf was the best recruitment ground on earth, filled with high-quality targets. Once recruited, the vetting and training of these new sources would be much easier in the United States than overseas. In fact, some of the top clandestine service spies had been recruited in the United States. Among those, a hefty percentage had simply volunteered. The most influential person in my initial discussion about the new job was Mary Margaret Graham, who had served as Chief NR a couple of years earlier. She emphasized relationships with CEOs as the key to success. With their understanding and trust, NR could leverage a company's resources and access worldwide. "Think of what you can do working with a major multinational company," she said. "Yeah, but how do you think I will fit into that bunch?" I asked. I'd encountered foreigners of all sorts. Simple clerks, feudal potentates, communist spies, vicious killers, dull diplomats, crazy bush pilots, heroic warriors, corrupt bureaucrats, proud dirt farmers, crafty con men, selfless aid workers, and even witch doctors. This was different. I could not recall meeting a Fortune 500 CEO, a university president, or a world-class scientist. For that matter, I was unfamiliar with my country after devoting my professional life to service in the foreign field and focusing on foreign issues even when in the United States. I felt like a prodigal son, pondering the consequences of returning to my homeland. Mary Margaret rolled her eyes and laughed. "Just tell them what you did in Afghanistan. Give them a copy of Woodward's book, Bush at War, and tell them you're Hank. Don't be shy about it. They will love you." Approximately a year earlier, at the CIA's request, I had granted Bob Woodward an interview recounting the CIA's role in post-9/11 Afghanistan. Public Affairs Officer Bill Harlow had accompanied me to Woodward's plush home in Georgetown for the two-hour discussion. This was the first and only time that I spoke to a journalist as a CIA officer. Woodward, exceedingly polite and polished, asked many questions. I followed Harlow's lead regarding what I could or could not answer. I had far more latitude than I initially thought. Woodward wrote an accurate and balanced account based on many interviews with many different perspectives. My colleagues in the CIA and some others in the U.S. government obviously knew that I was the Hank mentioned in the book. So did an increasing number of family and friends. Others, including SAIS classmates, knew or suspected. Mary Margaret emphasized that most Americans wanted to help the CIA, at least to some degree. This surprised me, given all the negative media and popular fiction that portrayed CIA officers as meatheads or miscreants or both. The 9/11 violation of our homeland made things different, I understood, but how different? Honest, thoughtful, and trustworthy, Mary Margaret told me to take the assignment. She reminded me it was an opportunity, and, more important, my duty. As I studied NR and mulled over the pros and cons, there was another factor that I was reluctant to admit. Spending a couple of days in San Diego instead of Somalia somehow seemed, well, just more attractive. I wondered if I was getting old. I could already hear my Africa Division, CTC, and SAD colleagues busting my balls. Greg, in particular, would be unrelenting. A couple of days later, I called Kappas. Chief NR, it should be fun. I'll take it. Thanks. You're welcome, he said. I hung up the phone and thought, I should have asked him for a branch office in Vail or Aspen just to irritate him. I started calling senior officers who had worked for me abroad or in CTC. I would need their help to staff some NR chief of station assignments that would soon be available. When I arrived in NR, I received a series of briefings. NR had stations and smaller bases scattered all over the country. Almost all were under commercial cover. Some stations worked more on counterterrorism. Others focused more on political, economic, and scientific intelligence. A couple of the bigger offices covered almost everything. The scope of work was vast because NR served as a recruiting and collection platform for the entire clandestine service, and NR's private sector partners worked as a volunteer force of American citizen spies who roamed the world. The value of the intelligence was critical. While the CIA botched the WMD assessment in Iraq in the lead-up to the Gulf War, NR officers had supplied the U.S. military with valuable reports about Iraqi infrastructure. U.S. contractors had rebuilt much of Iraq after the Iran-Iraq War, and some had retained their information and provided it to NR. With U.S. military requirements in hand, NR began to task its nationwide network. This produced immediate results. In one case, an NR source identified a specific Iraqi military target next to a daycare center and a restaurant. NR triple-checked the geo-coordinates, compared it with data from other collections assets, and then supplied the detailed report to the U.S. military. The next day, NR officers watched on cable news as a U.S. military briefer illustrated an example of their precision bombing, the target obliterated and the daycare center unscathed. NR, sometimes working with the FBI, also recruited former Iraqi government officials resident in the United States who provided key intelligence. More than half a dozen provided critical targeting information. Others identified potential defectors. Others recruited sources from among their families and clans. NR produced hundreds of reports for our policy and military customers. The NR briefings revealed breathtaking advances in biosciences, artificial intelligence, robotics, and nanotechnology that affected the practice of intelligence and war. I began referring to this as the Barn Revolution. The examples seemed endless, and some were scary. One day, perhaps soon, cyber infections could shut down huge swaths of infrastructure. Genetic engineers could transform humans into advanced fighting machines with immense speed, strength, stamina, and resilience. Genetically altered pathogens could wipe out millions of people. Micro-robotic engineering, replicating the aerodynamics of insects, could produce tiny UAVs capable of spying on unsuspecting suspects. U.S. companies were manufacturing smaller beacons or tracking devices with greater transmission power and longevity, which afforded the CIA new tools to improve tradecraft. Of course, foreign intelligence services were embarked on similar programs. The amalgamation and analysis of vast amounts of data posed great challenges and opportunities. Intelligence agencies, including the CIA, eagerly sought to apply this commercial information technology. When I considered what the future might hold, the value of the private sector to U.S. intelligence seemed even greater. The U.S. government could not match the scope and pace of development in BARN and other technologies. And while other parts of the CIA, such as the Directorate of Science and Technology, explored direct, practical applications in the national security community, NR leveraged the human value at the confluence of espionage and science.